come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The legal justification for marriage in America now apparently is because you want to. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is a trial attorney by training, but a scholar and student of Bible prophecy by desire. He, in fact, teaches a weekly course, and I don't know if course is the right word for it, but it's a weekly view or analysis of world events through a prophetic lens at Fellowship Bible Chapel in Columbus, Ohio, where he is a teaching pastor. His weekly prophecy update is available on the internet via YouTube and other places, and we'll put links to those in the show notes. It's our honor to welcome back to the Bunker John Haller. John,
Derek. Good to be with you again, Derek.
Where to begin with this? You're an attorney. I'm not. I harbored a brief fantasy of going to law school, but once I discovered I could get paid to talk into a microphone, the idea of studying that hard went out the window. But I do have pretty good reading comprehension. So I can only assume that the right to same-sex marriage found by five of the Supreme Court justices must be written in invisible ink in the Constitution. Where did they find the legal justification for the ruling that came down last Friday?
They don't, as a general rule. This has been I'm not sure where to begin, but I've been sort of very I don't want to say depressed. I've been very distressed about the rulings that came out last week. There were actually two of them on consecutive days, written by one of the majority opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts in the Obamacare decision. Mm-hmm. And then, which just was, I was livid at his ruling and his reasoning. And in that just, That's an important, maybe that's a good starting point to get to some of the conclusions that I think are valid. And in that case, the court, the issue was whether certain tax credits could be given to people who had not signed up through exchanges that were sponsored by a state, a capital S state, which everybody knows in legislation that comes out of Congress, it refers to one of the 50 states. Not that many states set up the exchanges. And so then people had to sign up at the federal exchange, but their insurance was much more expensive because they didn't get the credits. So then the litigation was over whether those credits, then Obama came in and said, well, we're going to give those credits. He wrote something into the law that was not there. And so then the question came, what did the statute mean? What did Congress mean when it set up the statute? And without going into too much analysis, essentially what happened was the court, the majority opinion of the court, six justices, the five that ruled in favor of same-sex marriage plus Chief Justice Roberts, spent 21 pages discussing what is meant by established by the states. Now, that is a very simple issue, but because they wanted to reach a political decision, at least Roberts did, and Roberts didn't want it to be a 5-4. He wrote the majority opinion, and I wrote to some of my attorney friends, and I just said, this is horrendous. I mean, Roberts is a major disappointment. He's a disaster, and if he had a conscience, he would resign. Mm-hmm. Because he did this in the prior Obamacare case, and he did it in this one. And what it really does, I think Scalia's dissent, I'm going to mark myself as kind of an extremist now. Scalia's dissents are usually the best reasoned ones, Alito and Scalia coming out of the court. It's an attack on the rule of law. In his dissent in the Obamacare case, Scalia said, essentially, this strikes at the heart of our democracy. Congress enacts a law, and then the Supreme Court comes along and says that you didn't mean what you said, so we're gonna rewrite the law so that it can mean what we want, so that it can be valid and do what you want to accomplish. Well, the ironic thing, or the cognitive dissonance that occurred, was Friday. Roberts comes out and writes a scathing dissent in the same-sex marriage case, saying this court is not a legislature. But the day before he was. I mean, I see this everywhere, Derek. It's one of the leading indicators that we live in the end times. Is I describe it as a fog of deception. In Matthew chapter 24, when Jesus was warning, the disciples asked him, well, what will the signs be? The one that Jesus talked about the most, I think he mentioned it four times than any other in that particular passage, in the parallel passage over in Luke, was deception. Take heed that no one deceive you. And as I look through the scripture and sort of piece together, you know, different prophecies about the end times, the one indicator is that there's massive deception that's going on. It's confusion. It's in people who are, I think, you know, infused with the Holy Spirit, are sitting back and wondering, like, what is going on? Why can't people see how moronic their reasoning is at times? And when I look at the scriptures, it talks about this deception operates in the church. It operates on a religious level. It operates on a moral level, a cultural level, and a geopolitical level. So as I look around and I see these various things that are going on, I have no doubt that we live near the end of time. I mean, I'm not going to set any dates, but a number of years ago, I had a conversation with Tom McMahon. He was at a conference with Dave Hunt. And I sat with Tom at lunch and, you know, this was back in the early days when watchmen such as myself and Tom McMahon were looking at this emerging church that was coming, that was largely based on sort of postmodern feelings. Their theology was governed a lot by feelings. And at that time, Tom said, you know, when Dave and I wrote Seduction of Christianity 25 years ago, or 20 years ago, I guess, at that time, he said, we didn't think it could get any worse. But now this emerging church has come along, and it's so far worse than we could even imagine that I just don't know how much worse it can be. Well, that was 7 years ago that I probably had that conversation with Tom, and look where we are now. I mean, and so now the Supreme Court, it takes them 21 pages to wrestle with a statute that is perfectly clear, established by the states. There's no question what that means. But they wanted to reach a political decision. Well, then you go to the next day when they issued the Obergefell decision. And when you read Kennedy's majority opinion, it's all based on feelings. The right to same-sex marriage is not found in the Constitution, but it's found in the right of dignity. You know, the right to equal protection under the law now becomes the right to dignity. And there's some stunning quotes from Kennedy's majority opinion. For example, in one part he says, there is no difference between same and opposite sex couples with respect to this principle of marriage. And it's just like, well, how can you say that? There's a huge difference between opposite sex couples and same sex couples. There really is. There's a whole complementarian component. There's the order of creation and that type of thing. But it's postmodernism run amok, in my view. And now we have these opinions coming from the highest court in the land, the most, you know, the great constitutional scholars. Everybody went to Harvard and Yale up there. That's the elite law schools in our country. And they're not reasoning. They're basing their opinion on feelings.
And I saw that in a clip that I watched from Fox News the other night, where Megyn Kelly was talking with the Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, and they played a clip of Mr. Obergefell after the decision, holding up a picture of his partner and dedicating the victory to his partner, and he seemed like a nice fellow. And I, you know, with years involved in amateur theater and vocal music, have come into contact with probably more gays than most average folks do. And I don't have any problem of associating with them or calling them friend even. But it seemed to me, but even based on that video clip, because Megyn Kelly asked the question of Tony Perkins, how can you deny such a dear man, his right to, and she wasn't advocating for it. She was just, asking Tony Perkins to justify his position. Have we reached a point in history? I mean, it sounds to me that this is what you're saying. When the visual image of a clean cut man who's obviously, overcome with emotion and seems to be a very nice guy outweighs the law of the land?
I think it is. I've cited this example in some other context. By training, I'm a trial lawyer. I've been a trial lawyer for 35 years. When I was a young lawyer, we would go to seminars to help us become better trial lawyers. And the seminars were always oriented back in the early days of my practice around the effective presentation of facts. I don't know when the shift occurred, but I have seen a shift that now those seminars are more oriented to not effectively presenting the facts, but how do you hook people emotionally and get them on your side? So while – and the amazing thing is, though, I've seen this in church denominations and in individual churches where people will get up and rail against the effects of postmodernism, not realizing that they're as postmodern as they come, and they're basing everything on feelings as well. They don't see it in their own lives, and it's very difficult because the culture, it's all around us. And so look, I think Megyn Kelly, she's a lawyer. She's a pretty rational person. She's very bright, but she falls into the trap as well, asking the question, well, how can you deny this nice man? Mm-hmm. Well, if that's the standard, you can't deny them anything. You have to base it on emotion. And so this has been a problem in the Supreme Court for many, many years. There was a line of cases back in the late 50s and 60s, everybody would call them the right to privacy cases. And by no means am I a constitutional Supreme Court scholar, but when you study the development of law in law school, especially in your constitutional law class, you start with Marbury versus Madison, and then you move on very quickly to the right of privacy cases to show the development of that area of the law, and you end up with sort of the penultimate right to privacy case, which is Roe versus Wade.
Yeah.
So in 73, when they wrote versus Wade, when they wrote the decision in Roe versus Wade, I'm trying to remember who wrote that decision. One of the more liberal justices on the Supreme Court said, well, we don't really find the right to an abortion, or this right to privacy in the Constitution, but we find it in the penumbra, the shadows of the Constitution. Well, once that becomes your standard, you can find anything you want lurking in the shadows. But Derek, the impact of this everywhere in geopolitics. I mean, there was the Tunisian terrorist attack the other day, mm-hmm. Probably done by an Al-Qaeda or ISIS group. Well, the guy was clearly shouting the Islamic statement that they all shout when he was shooting people and killing them, slaughtering them on the beach there in Tunisia. But then you have David Cameron, the Prime Minister of England, get up, and nobody's forcing him to do this. He says, well, you know, that's not Islam. That's not Islam is a religion of peace. And so you have this disconnect there from the reality of the what the person identified as their motivation. Right. He can deny as doing because I guess it makes him feel better or feel less insecure if he just denies reality that's sitting, staring him right in the face. So it sort of rears its head in all different aspects of life and culture.
It's bizarre. There is an aspect, I think, that that progressives just can't seem to get their head around the aspect of faith or the concept, I guess is the word I'm looking for, the concept that the people of faith will actually guide their lives, live their lives according to what they believe. And the guys in ISIS, the Islamic State, have been flat out telling us for a year since they announced the caliphate what they plan to do, putting it out in a pretty slick magazine, which is named for the town where they're supposed to have their big climactic battle against the forces
of
Dabiq. So, and yet we in the West, progressives, continue to presume to tell these guys that they don't know what it is they actually believe.
Well, of course, the response of them. And I think there was no question but that this was a direct response to statements by Obama about the same-sex marriage decision. I mean, I've seen the video, as disturbing as it is. I did watch it.
Yeah.
Of them throwing four gay men off a five-story building.
Right, and then tweeting it out, hashtag love wins.
Yeah, and it's a direct in-your-face thing. And so it's this inability to recognize the evil in our presence that, that's problematic to me. But, you know, I see people in the church, you know, I see some of the different theories about, you know, 9/11 and stuff that we did this because we just made up the evil that's Islam because we wanted to control people. But it's interesting now that the people that want to use should be using Islam to control us by enacting more and more restrictive laws are the ones that are saying that Islam's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the whole thing is just, it's very, very, Doug Krieger calls it the city of confusion. It's, mm-hmm. it's what Babel must have been like after the languages were mixed up. Everything was confused.
Yeah.
And that's what I feel personally on a daily basis. It's like, you know, if I had the anchor of the Word of God and the truth of the Scripture and the reality of Jesus Christ and the reality of prophecy being, you know, fulfilled or on the verge of being fulfilled right in front of our eyes, I think I'd be very, very distressed. I'm distressed enough as it is, but it was not a good day for the decisions that came out on Thursday, then Friday. It really undermines, in my view as a lawyer, and I'm sure that my fellow lawyers will disagree with me, it is a direct attack and undermining of the rule of law in our country because now anything goes. Dennis Prager, who I listen to every day, good thinker, makes good arguments, conservative guy. His column this week is the Judeo-Christian America is dead. It's
mm-hmm.
over.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I said in my prophecy update on Sunday, that it's over, and it's sort of like what we thought of as America, even in its side, you know, and we know there's problems that we've had, and we've done some awful things, but we've had, you know, a pretty good life here in America and the West, and it was based at least in part on the Judeo-Christian tradition of morality, but it's gone now. It does not exist. I don't think it exists in the majority of people in this country anymore.
No, it was astonishing. Again, I'm no attorney or legal expert by any stretch, but again, I've got fairly decent reading comprehension, and I can read the Constitution. And it was, and then I read some of the opinions that came out of the decisions on Thursday and Friday, and I also noted the strange dichotomy in Judge Roberts' opinions on Thursday and then on Friday. It's almost as though language, words don't matter anymore, that Congress can just come up with a policy outcome that they want and just let the court go ahead and rule on it. And suddenly it's the law of the land. Where does this go? I mean, you spotted something that I also caught. It took one whole day after the court decision on Friday in the Obergefell case to for a public call published by Politico.com to legalize polygamy, mm-hmm. which is something conservatives had been warning about all through this process of arguing same-sex marriage. And in the article, the author of the piece at Politico admitted that advocates for same-sex marriage and for plural marriage knew that this would push us down the slippery slope, but they didn't want to admit it because it would really agitate conservatives. Conservatives were mocked for saying first this, then where does it go from there? Where do you think this leads now that same-sex marriage is the law of the land?
Well, I'm going to anchor this in the Bible. I mentioned this in my prophecy updates. And what we do is we look at the news, we look at things going on, because I think a lot of things are happening that are at least sort of end time stage setting. And we talk about what's going on in part to help our congregation and our little church to shape their worldview, to think about these issues from a biblical perspective. And so that's what we're trying to accomplish there. But one of the things I cite all the time is, and one of the things I've learned over the last 5 or 6 years is that the prophetic scriptures, from a Jewish perspective, you look at patterns, and it's the way Jesus taught. So Jesus in Luke chapter 17, he's teaching and he says, just before his coming, it will be as it was in the days of Noah. You know, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage. And then he says, and then it will also be as in the days of Lot. Now, as I've gone back and studied it, there is some, in connection with the days of Lot, there is some Talmudic tradition, older Talmudic tradition, that the marrying that was going on there was actually men giving marriage licenses for men to marry men. And I don't think you can be dogmatic that that's what was going on, because most of the people that were doing that are no longer around after the flood. And so but that was the belief of Jewish rabbis and scholars, at least in part, of what was going on. But there's no question is that was going on in the days of Lot in Sodom and Gomorrah. So if you look for a pattern, and you want to just focus on, excuse me here. If you want to look just for a pattern of the days of Lot, Scripture actually gives us a clue as to what that is like. And if you look over in 2 Peter chapter 2, it talks about what Lot was feeling like at the time, or what he was experiencing in the days of Lot. So in verse 4 of 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, if I could just read that, it says, "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought flood upon the world of the ungodly." And then he says, for some reason, I haven't figured out how to turn off that iTunes connection between my cell phone and my computer. And I have somebody who's insisting on calling me, so maybe I can shut off my phone here. Okay. Hopefully that'll stop. I apologize for that.
No worries.
But the pattern that occurred at the time of Lot, so it says in verse 6, "And if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly lives thereafter, and if he rescued righteous Lot," and then it says this is what Lot felt like, "oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard, that righteous man," now we can argue, some of the things Lot was doing in Sodom, offering up his daughters, but yeah. he's still called righteous. While living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds. Well, so if we take Jesus at his word that the pattern of the end times will be like the days of Lot, what I've told my church is if you're tormented, if you're bothered by this, if this really bothers you at the core of your soul, that's to be expected. And that's a good sign if you're righteous. In Ezekiel chapter 9, before the judgment of, final judgment of Judah by the Babylonians, you know, people were, the man with the writing case was told to go through and mark the righteous people, those who sighed and groaned at all the abominations that they saw around us. So if that's your visceral reaction to this, that's a good sign, I think, in terms of your personal spiritual walk. But you need to understand that as this grows, you're going to feel that way more often. Mm. Now, to your next question is, where does this go? I'm not optimistic. It's effectively over in terms of same-sex marriage. I suppose it's theoretically possible that there could be a massive repentance and another great awakening here in America, and the people would repent and they would enact a statute or a constitutional amendment to rectify this problem. But as I watch the candidates on the party that you would expect to do that, most of them have caved. Mm-hmm. I mean, even I think Marco Rubio came out and said, well, you know, this is the Supreme Court's ruled and, you know, it's now the law of the land and we need to learn to live with it. So I personally am not optimistic that this is going to change. I think it's the way we are. You're going to see more and more countries around the world adopt this. There is now no effective defense against polygamy becoming well accepted, and people are pushing it already. They're pushing the envelope on that. And the other concern I have is that there'll be an attack on the age of consent, that there'll be an attack to lower the age of consent, mm-hmm. Which I find very troubling. So that, you know, the age of consent, when you can consent to a sexual relationship, without somebody being, you know, sued for or charged with statutory rape.
Right, right.
It varies from state to state, but, you know, some places, if it's somebody between 14 and 18, you have to be under 18 years old, you know, for it to not be statutory rape. It varies from state to state. I think most states, the age of consent is about 16. Mm-hmm. But I expect that to be lowered. And the argument will be, well, look, they're sophisticated kids. They know that this is going on. We're teaching them in first and second grade about mm-hmm. all this.
Right.
So what they can make up their minds.
Sure. Planned Parenthood has been pushing this for a while. And we're seeing this in other areas of life, too. We're seeing over in Europe, the Netherlands, the Pediatrics Association in the Netherlands is pushing to remove the age of lower the age of consent or eliminate the age of consent for assisted suicide. So why not? As far as allowing children to be given in marriage.
Well, and then you couple it with the whole transgender movement right now.
Gender fluidity. Yeah.
Which, you know, it's interesting that the first trans sexual reassignment surgery in America was done at Johns Hopkins Medical School or Medical College or Hospital, probably back in the 60s. And they don't do them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the person who used to head up, be one of the important people in that department, I think his name is McHugh.
Yes.
He wrote a pretty powerful, he's written a number of powerful articles, but one was in the Wall Street about a year ago on the op-ed page saying, you know, look, the reality of it is that we can't change the physical facts. They come into the operation and we may add or remove things from them, but when they come out of the operation, they're still a male. And most of the people that struggle with this as a child, if you continue to treat them as a male, if they're a male, and you don't give in to their feelings, they will, over 90% of them will come out with no problems.
Right.
But now, because feelings rule, you know, a 7-year-old kid says, I want to dress as a girl, and now he's got parents who are going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And are celebrated for it. You know, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie with the daughter Shiloh, who wants to be called John and dress as a boy. And they're celebrated for it.
Well, I saw that there was some things going on with regard to one of Will Smith's children. Son who wants to wear a dress. And there was an article in Fortune magazine that I saw referenced the other day about how corporate America is moving beyond the gender thing. And in that article, they cite a study that was done a couple years ago where 60% of the people surveyed between the ages of 14 and 34 said that gender was fluid. That's 60%. So when I see that, I'm thinking this thing, it's been building for a while, but now it's manifesting itself on every level. It seems like there's, you know, everybody talks about in Bible prophecy, there's this acceleration and convergence of everything happening at the same time. And it is. Now, all of that's been building and in place. So like in the Supreme Court case, you know, the downfall really started with Roe versus Wade when they started looking for things in the shadows. And now it sort of culminates with, well, yeah, we know that this has been what society has done for millennia. Even Kennedy acknowledges that, but we have to look at the dignity of the individual. So I was pretty sure that Kennedy was going to write the decision. He wrote the decision in Lawrence about 10 years ago that struck down sodomy laws, which were rarely enforced, but occasionally they were enforced if it was a pretty egregious act. And he overturned those and said, you can't enact that. And so the question then becomes is like, what can we do?
Yeah.
What can we enact? I mean, this really is an attack on democracy. I mean, I was actually in California meeting with a pastor friend the morning after the decision came down by Vaughn Walker in San Francisco to strike down California's Proposition 8. And my pastor friend had been one of the leading proponents of that in his church. And we were quite distressed at breakfast that morning. And as you read the opinion, it was essentially based on the people voted that way because they're bigots. And we're not going to let them vote that way if they're bigots. So, and that was a Reagan appointee confirmed under Bush 41, Vaughn Walker in San Francisco. So it's on both sides of the aisle. I'm just not optimistic that it's going to change until the end gets wrapped up here. I think it gets worse.
The irony of that decision in California, by the way, was that it wasn't because of white voters that Proposition 8 passed. It was because of strong support in the Latino and African American communities, who are traditionally very much in the Democratic corner when it comes to electing representatives. But on that particular issue, they were way out of step. So anyway, it's just bizarre. I didn't even realize this as I was doing some research on the topic this past week, that you'll see a lot of news reports that this decision that came down Friday from the Supreme Court strikes down the definitions of marriage as a man and a woman, the biblical definition, or really the definition of marriage, in states like Missouri, where it was in the Constitution. And there are supporters who say, well, you know, it was already legal in 36 states, but what I hadn't realized was that only in what was it, like 11 states, where the residents of those states had actually voted to make marriage.
That's right.
And in the other 25 states, it had been established by judicial fiat.
That's correct. Yeah, I think the only circuit that held the line for traditional marriage was the Sixth Circuit here that covers Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, and Michigan. So the Obergefell, he was a part of a gay couple from Cincinnati. Had brought that case, and they had lost it all the way up through they may have won at the district court level, and then the Sixth Circuit reversed it, and then it went up to the Supreme Court because of the other circuits were in conflict. So yeah, the voters, it was changed by voters in about 11 states. The other 25 or 26, it was changed by judicial decision, mm-hmm. usually of a district court. And then if you had, for example, in California, it was changed by the decision of one judge in San Francisco. The whole state law was struck down.
Yeah.
Well, then you would think that the attorney general of the estate and the governor of the state would defend the properly enacted constitutional law of the state. But, Schwarzenegger and, the attorney general at the time, Jerry Brown, refused to defend the thing on court, on appeal. So then the whole question on appeal was whether the people who were trying to support the constitutional amendment enacted by the majority of Californians had standing. And so this concept of standing is used to, well, of course, I don't think there's any question, but they have standing, representative of the people. If the attorney general of California and the governor don't want to defend it, somebody should.
Yeah.
Because the people voted for it. But the same thing happened with DOMA. When DOMA started to be challenged, Obama and Eric Holder said, well, we don't agree with that, so we're not going to defend it.
And Judge Walker, just as an aside, was also the guy who struck down the lawsuit filed by the Electronic Frontiers Foundation against AT&T and the National Security Agency for their countrywide wiretap on the AT&T trunk lines in San Francisco. Judge Walker said that since so many people were affected by the wiretap, no individual had standing to bring the lawsuit. It's okay if they spy on all of us, it's no good. But if you're going to spy on the whole country, then nobody has standing to sue.
So break the law on a massive scale and you get away with it.
Yeah, it's like the old joke, if I owe the bank $500, it's my problem. If I owe them $5 million, it's their problem.
It's a very distressing time. And I've told people, I said, imagine you're a lawyer and you have someone who has a good case factually, but you're going to go in front of a bunch of 25 to 35 year old postmoderns and present those facts. But your client is not very emotionally appealing. You're dead. The law and the facts, they don't mean anything.
Yeah.
And so it really is a time for grave concern, I think, on the part of thinking people.
Well, let's focus in on how this affects us as Christians. We saw this week, in fact, yesterday, as we record this on Thursday, July 2nd, the Episcopal Church USA basically sounded its own death knell by approving the performance of religious same-sex marriage ceremonies in all of its congregations, joining the United Church of Christ and the Presbyterian Church USA in a race toward the scrap heap of history. But churches that are going to hold the line, the Southern Baptist Convention has already come out and said it's not going to go along with this. What can churches and Christians who want to hold the line and say, we're not going to be a part of a ceremony that is described in God's own words as abomination. How is this going to affect us and how do we respond?
Well, one thing that I was encouraged about was a lot of pastors did go into the pulpit last Sunday and speak about it. I know our pastor at Fellowship Bible Chapel suspended his Hebrew series to talk about it. But I think that churches, as a practical matter, they also need to take steps to defend themselves. And I think there's a difference of opinion on how that's done. Alliance Defending Freedom has about a 40-page pamphlet out there as to what churches should do to protect themselves legally. Because even though Kennedy sort of gave a little bit of a branch like, well, this won't affect religious institutions. When the Obergefell case was argued orally, the Solicitor General from the Obama administration, Solicitor General of the United States, when asked a question by one of the justices, I think it was Alito, Well, we know that Bob Jones lost their tax exemption because they wouldn't approve interracial dating or mm-hmm. marriage. Is this what's going to happen to institutions like colleges that only have married housing that's between people of different sexes? They won't allow same-sex couples housing. Are they going to lose their tax exemption? And the Solicitor General said, you know, he wouldn't give a definitive answer. Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't give a definitive answer because the answer is you better believe they're going to come after that. They're going to come after that like a pack of hungry hyenas, I guess is the best description that I can think of. It is – so Alliance Defending Freedom has – you can go to Alliance Defending Freedom, and I'm sure it's pretty easy to find on their website – this pamphlet that will tell churches sort of the steps that they need to do. But it's going to hurt, churches. I think the churches will probably be at the end of the line, but it's going to be first on religious institutions like schools and colleges and universities that hold the line based on Christian conscience. That you saw some of the beginnings of that in some of the Obamacare regulations that required institutions to provide for certain types of contraceptions that were abortifacients. And the Obama administration, they didn't care that people had a conscientious or religious objection to that. Well, you're a public entity and you have to do it. We don't really care. And in California, it's gone to the point where they're requiring churches to do it. Hmm. And I know that Pastor Jack Hibbs and Calvary Chapel Chino Hills is involved in some lawsuits with the state of California right now, and they said we're not going to comply. So how churches respond is, you know, churches have to be very clear that they only marry opposite sex couples. They might want to limit it to members. Follow the steps in the Alliance Defending Freedom pamphlet. I think it's good solid advice. But some churches have even taken the position that they're not going to perform weddings anymore. Mm-hmm. So to avoid the problem entirely, so people can go and get married civilly. But I know some churches, some large churches that have just said, we're not going to conduct any marriages at our church anymore.
Yeah. I see that even the state of Mississippi, a government agency, the state of Mississippi is considering just getting out of the marriage licensing business altogether.
Yeah. So then it sort of becomes, you know, cause it's been an institution that's been encouraged. It's encouraged under the tax code. It's encouraged by, all these different rules and regulations and statutes, and all those are out the window now. It's, who knows what it's going to be like when it comes in. So, but look, I've also seen some things from some of the progressive, or as I refer to them, the fascist, wing of politics, that are sort of coming clean now and saying, this has really never been about marriage. This is about breaking down moral categories that society has recognized for a long time. It's a stunning thing to watch. I mean, when I watch what the Obama administration has done, Bush was doing some of the same things too. So let's be honest about that. But we've really had what I consider to be a soft coup in this country. The way the unitary executive power has been exercised, somewhat under Bush, but even more so under the Obama administration. He's going to do what he wants. This is different than we've had in our country. So when I say a soft coup, I mean that the executive has become sort of preeminent. And effectively, even good commentators will say that he's effectively shut down Congress. And now the court's even gone further and said, we don't care what you people vote for. We don't care what Congress says. We're going to do what we think is right. And so you got a single unitary executive or five justices on the Supreme Court making a lot of decisions that they shouldn't be making. Mm-hmm. The checks and balances that were set up in our Constitution are just, they're not recognized anymore by a lot of people. So this is a dark day for America.
Hmm. You kind of addressed this, and I just want to kind of hit this point one more time because it's kind of been my feeling all the way along. And looking at the motivations the motives behind some of these lawsuits. People who go into a Christian-owned business and insist that they want a openly professing conservative, theologically Christians to take their wedding photographs or provide the food for the wedding or what have you, or offer a place for a wedding, knowing that these people are opposed to the lifestyle of the people coming in and asking for the services. It seems to me that if I wanted a really good job at done with the photographs at my wedding, I wouldn't go to somebody who is hostile to my way of life and ask them to do it and insist that they do it to the point of taking them to court to force them to do it. Again, is this about recognizing the legitimacy of same-sex marriage, or is there something more at work here? And why has our culture bent over so far for a population that, according to the CDC, is maybe 3% of the population?
Well, I think my personal opinion is that the 3% number, given the way culture is going, it will soon be understated. There's just too much, especially among younger people, same-sex experimentation going on. I think we've really reached a tipping point. But even if it is small, this is about changing the major institutions of society. And this is a direct attack on religion. There cannot be any doubt about that. And they want to break down that category because they don't think it's important. And, you know, I've often sort of mused about, well, what could a photographer do? You know, maybe the photographer could say, well, you know, my wedding pictures are always watermarked with, the verse where Jesus says that marriage is between a man and a woman. that's just how I do all my photographs.
Yeah.
I think they would be within their rights to do that. There are a lot of things that people do. They have discretion as to whether they deal with certain people. Whether, you know, they can refuse service. You know, they don't, no shoes, no shirt, no service. Some of the gay pride parades I saw in San Francisco, that would exclude a number of the participants in that parade because they had shoes on, but that was it.
About it, yeah.
No, it wasn't about it. It was it. Walking down the middle of the street, you know, just standing there in a park and nobody, it's like nobody even notices. So, I think the situation is more dire than we really want to admit. I do think it's the days of Lot. It's the days of Noah. It's what Jesus said to look for as a pattern. And, it's here. So, I mean, I think Christians need to continue to do the right thing, but they need to understand that, persecution, is probably going to come to the church as a result of this. I don't see how that will not happen. And good pastors that I know that have been thinking about this for a long time have come to the conclusion that, yeah, indeed, they're, one pastor referred to them as Bonhoeffer moments, where we're going to have to decide some pretty serious things as to what we're going to do in terms of resisting what the state is going to make us do.
And it's coming from all sides because even though there've been a number of states, including Indiana, which interestingly their religious freedom restoration act went into effect yesterday on the heels of this, this decision. Of course, there was a big uproar in Indiana when Governor Pence signed that bill. But here in Missouri, the Satanic Temple based out of Detroit is suing the state of Missouri and trying to use the Religious Freedom Restoration Act here in Missouri as justification to overturn the 72-hour waiting period required before an abortion. So it's coming from all sides. They're using a political and legal jujitsu move to use the power of government, which Christians maybe have gotten too reliant upon. I mean, even if, what's going on in society today, if the Barna Group is correct in its methodology, there are still far more Bible-believing Christians in America than there are homosexuals. But we've perhaps gotten too used to having the majority and using the power of government to get things, make things happen the way we want them to. And the other side has now gotten savvy enough to to try and use that use the other edge of those legal swords against us.
Well, I think the state of the church is, and that's probably one of the more distressing things, is the state of the church. And among the people that are my friends on Facebook, I did not see this, but I know a number of my Christian friends complained about the fact that their longtime Christian friends were putting up rainbow things in their profiles. And Christians are like, well, it's, and I saw some of these arguments, you know, the arguments that took place, and they're just like, well, it's just about love. It's just about love. And why should we deny these people their dignity? And so it becomes, so there are people who claim to be followers of Christ, but they're capitulating to the culture. Derek, there's a very good article at the gospelcoalition.org blog by Kevin DeYoung, 40 Questions for Christians Now Waving Rainbow Flags. It's a phenomenal series, and let me just read the first few questions for you. How long have you believed that gay marriage is something to be celebrated? This is to Christians. Mm-hmm. What Bible verses led you to change your mind? How would you make a positive case from Scripture that sexual activity between two persons of the same sex is a blessing to be celebrated? When Jesus spoke on this, what did he say? Do you think Jesus would have been okay with this? So, you know, they're very probing questions, and I'm concerned that the orientation of the broader, sort of speaking in generalities, evangelical church for some time has been to give sermons that are good advice, ways to make a better life for yourself, mm-hmm. 5 steps to be a better leader in business,
right,
and that type of thing. And that stuff has left people totally, completely unable to defend their faith. They don't even know what it is anymore. And so while Barna says there's a majority, if you look at some of the, you've drilled down into some of the other statistics of Barna, where he talks about, you know, do people hold to these 5 fundamentals of the faith?
Oh, I know. It's only 9% of the American public, American adults.
Right. And you get into younger people, it's 3%.
Right, right.
So if that's the case, then we have a much, much, much bigger problem than we have. I've advocated for some time. Did I? Am I still?
No, you're still here. No, nope. Now you just cut yourself off.
Okay. I've advocated for some time that if you're afraid to go out into the world to evangelize, then do it in the pews of your church. One, if people are true believers, they ought to be glad that you care enough to ask. They shouldn't be offended by it. And two, they shouldn't be offended if you ask, because they're there in a church where this is supposedly the core teaching of the church. So, you know, get over yourself and, you know, go to there are plenty of people in our churches that are not true believers, and we just have to recognize that fact. And I think unfortunately it may be worse than we think. There's always, and the scriptural motif is always a remnant. It's never a massive, number. It's usually a remnant that say, you know, Lot and his 2 daughters, Noah and his wife and 6 children and their spouses. 3 children and their spouses. So that's the motif. So we need to kind of reorient ourselves to that. It's just, it's a troubling time. I have to admit it's been something that I've wrestled with over the last week, especially. I knew this decision was coming. When they came out with that monstrosity of a decision on Thursday on the Obamacare thing, there was no doubt in my mind that the decision would be, what it was on Friday. I was surprised. I thought Roberts would write the decision as well based on what he said.
But. John Haller is a teaching pastor at Fellowship Bible Chapel in Columbus, Ohio. Where do people get the video that now, do you stream it live to the web as well as post it to YouTube?
Yeah, it's up on live stream. We keep changing the moniker a little bit on our live stream channel. So if you look either for Fellowship Bible Chapel Sunday morning live stream or Columbus Bible Prophecy Conference. That's, we hold conferences every now and then. It will be under that. If you go to YouTube and you just type in my name or FB Chapel, you should come up with our YouTube channel. And then you can go to fbchapel.com, our website, fbchapel.com. And there'll be a link to the, I think there's a link to the live stream. And there's also a link to the audio podcast, and there's a link to the YouTube channel there. So God's really blessed that aspect of our ministry. We get emails from all over the world, most for the most part supportive. Every now and then, pretty detailed things about what's wrong with me and what's wrong with what I say. But for the most part, we've been really, really surprised at the outpouring of support. It's really taken off this year. I think through the end of June, we've had over 400,000 views on our YouTube channel this year. We're just a little tiny church in Columbus, Ohio. So we just post some things on Facebook when it's up, and we don't advertise or anything else. So I think there's a real hunger for people out there for this type of teaching. I know some of the teaching you're doing with your fellowship on Sunday, just going through the Bible and stuff. I think people are starving for that.
Agreed. Because there are too many churches out there that aren't providing it.
The thing I hear most often, and when I talk to other people that have itinerant ministries and Bible prophecy and Bible teaching, is everywhere they go, people say, do you know a church in my area? Can you help me find a church? Because I can't find anything that's holding fast to the faith. Mm-hmm. That's itself as a sign of the end times as well. And it's very distressing because, in reality, it won't be popular with the culture if you hold fast to the faith, but it's really not that, in some respects, it's not that hard. You know, you just open the Bible and go through it and talk about it and teach it, and it will change people's lives. But we think we have to be very clever and have all this extra stuff. And the reality is, I just don't think it's that difficult.
Well, I think the reality, too, is that those churches that are trying really hard to conform their doctrine to the culture, I mentioned the Episcopal Church USA, the Presbyterian Church USA, and the United Church of Christ. All three of those denominations are shedding members so quickly that at the current rate of decline, none of them will be around halfway to the next to the next century. And they have done everything that the culture wants them to do. They are accepting same-sex marriage. There's no restriction on the sexual behavior of the pastors, and yet they're losing membership left and right. It is the churches that are growing, if at all, are the seeker-friendly churches, but the churches that are holding fast to the teaching of the Word of God, yes, we're still shedding membership, but not nearly as quickly as those that have sold out to the culture.
Yeah, there's a group out there in evangelical churches working with evangelical churches. They're getting a lot of traction, especially with younger people, called the Reformation Project. It's Matthew Vines, a young homosexual man, I think from Kansas, around Kansas City, that's leading this. And they just had a training conference in Atlanta. Go look up Reformation Project on YouTube and watch the twisting of scripture that takes place at these meetings. Derek, it's unbelievable. It's appalling,
mm-hmm.
But that's where we are. If the Supreme Court can do that with clearly stated laws of the land, or they can make it up, when that spirit gets involved, even in formerly solid evangelical churches, it's over for them. And they're leading people down a very dark, dire path, and they're not teaching the gospel. They're not teaching the truth of the scriptures, and that's part of the final apostasy that we know is coming in the end times, and it's coming like a tsunami. And some of my teachings that I've done, I've at conferences, I've used a picture of the a video that I found of the tsunami, Boxing Day tsunami in 2004 in Asia, the Indian Ocean tsunami.
Right.
And there's a picture, I think this was in Thailand, and you see the pic. What happened was the water drained out of the bay, and people are out there walking around the rocks, and, oh, look at the pretty coral. You know, we usually have to snorkel out here to do this. Yeah, it's really weird, isn't it, that there's no water in the bay. And then people that are sort of up the hill or in the second story of a building, they're looking out and they see this white cap all the way across the horizon on the ocean. And they're like, what is that? You know, and they're like, oh, maybe the earthquake caused it. No, no, the earthquake couldn't cause it. Somebody goes, tsunami? And somebody goes, oh, yeah. Well, then you see all these, they then focus on all these pictures walking around in the bay, around looking at the rocks. And the tsunami, like a tsunami of judgment, I guess, a picture of the end times, is coming, and they're totally clueless. And you know that they're dead when the waves rush over them. There's just no way they survive. And it's, I think it's a perfect picture of the end times. There's a tsunami of judgment, God's judgment that's coming. It's predicted. I know it doesn't square with the usual notion that God is love, but it's what the Bible says. You can deny whether it's true or not, but it's a fact as to what's coming. Mm-hmm. And so we have to warn people as to what's coming.
Yeah. John, appreciate you taking time out of your workday to do this. And we'll put links to where folks can find your teachings on the web in the show notes. And we'll have to talk again, because I think you're right that the white caps are on the horizon, and things are getting dark.
Yeah, I agree with that. And Derek, God bless you and your ministry. Thanks for having me on.
I'll put a link in the show notes to where you can find John's weekly prophecy teaching at YouTube, and a link to the website for the Fellowship Bible Chapel as well. That weekly video teaching that John does on prophecy is really a version of, well, it's kind of like the daily news updates that I've been doing for Skywatch TV, except coming from somebody who's smarter than me, and with better understanding of Bible prophecy. So you can get it in a 1 week week in review format from John, and and probably get a better understanding of how all of those news events fit into prophecy than during the 10-minute updates that I provide through the week at skywatchtv.com. So I highly recommend taking a look at that, making that a regular part of viewing. And if you have a Roku device, I would add the YouTube app to your Roku account, and then make sure that your Roku account is set up so that you've subscribed to the Fellowship Bible Chapel feed. And that way you can watch John's teaching on your television through the YouTube app. Okay, it's sort of a backdoor way of having a Roku channel for anyone who does YouTube. In fact, at Skywatch TV, we were suggesting people do that for a bit until we got the Skywatch TV Roku channel set up and running. But anyway, highly recommended, and worth your time to view. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, as we've been doing some things around the house here, settling in, and things at work with the studio in transition, I've kind of let slip the scheduling for guests coming up here on A View from the Bunker. I had reached out to Mark Flynn, author of The Forbidden Secrets of the Rainbow, Forbidden Secrets of the Labyrinth, The Awakened Ones, The Hidden Destiny of America, and The Day After Tomorrow. Mark Flynn is the twin brother of David Flynn. And David, of course, was taken from us too soon. He's home with the Lord. An aggressive brain cancer claimed him. But Mark is as remarkable a thinker as David, apparently, as I'm finding out by reading this book. Sharon read this book when it was first released last year, and she was encouraging me to read it. But between all of the things that I was doing, working full-time as an outside salesman, which required some after-hours work to schedule appointments and so forth, plus a lot of the volunteer stuff I was doing for the Barbershop Harmony Society, it was just not in the cards for me to read the book. Well, I'm finally getting around to it, and what prompted it is an article that Mark posted to his blog this week called The Serpent and the Rainbow. And this was in response, of course, to the Supreme Court's ruling on same-sex marriage, in which he points out in this article, which I need to go back and read again to fully digest. But the takeaway is that the unification of the man and the woman, represented by the sun or Sol Invictus, the Greek god Attis, A-T-T-I-S, which is also a representation of the Nakash, which is the serpentine being that tempted Eve and Adam in the garden. The woman, of course, Eve, represented by the moon or the goddess Cybele, C-Y-B-E-L-E, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. Anyway, the unification of those two, the man and the woman, the Nakash and Eve, or the tempter and mankind, depicts the time when the Nakash takes on human form to rule the earth. Someday in the future, when the Nakash thinks he is going to rule the earth, the serpent has been separated from his love, Eve, since the garden. And as the Illuminated would describe, both the moon, Eve, and the sun, Nakash, have longed to be together once more after their unjust and harsh separation by God. Now, that's a summary of what these secret societies, these occult secret societies believe and teach their initiates, or at least the those who progress past the first few levels of to reach enlightenment. And it hit me like a thunderbolt as Sharon and I watched on Friday evening the Johnny Depp movie Transcendence. We no longer stream movies from Netflix. We've gone back to the old-fashioned method of actually having to watch physical discs. Out here in the country, we just don't have enough bandwidth allotted to us through our internet service plan. But in watching the movie, it struck me that what we were watching was a representation on screen of what Mark has been writing about in his book, at his website, in his articles. Because that's exactly what was taking place. The serpent, represented by the Johnny Depp character Will Caster. Will, the representative of the five I wills of the ascribed to Lucifer in Ezekiel 28, is separated from his wife, Evelyn, Eve, for whom Will built a garden at their home. A garden inside a Faraday cage, interestingly enough, to prevent, outside interference, electromagnetic interference, cell phone, Wi-Fi, so forth, getting in and disrupting the serenity of their little garden. Of course, Will is the victim of a violent anti-technology group called Rift that takes his life. And while he's dying, Eve falls to the temptation of uploading Will to a strong AI, a very powerful computer, essentially allowing Will to achieve apotheosis because he's very soon begins to demonstrate godlike capabilities, plays the stock market, makes millions and millions of dollars, sets up a huge server farm out in the Utah desert or somewhere out in the desert anyway, and begins tinkering with experiments or experimenting to tinker with human DNA and what it means to be human. And the interesting thing about this is that even though, ultimately the film shows that the goal of Will is to be reunited with Evelyn by uploading her into the computer and making her a god, as it were, as well. And the interesting thing to me was that even though the fears of the anti-technology group, the violent, hateful, bigoted, small-minded, backwards, Luddites, even though their fears were proven correct because Will Caster, when the opportunity arose, did start messing with human biology and creating his own little army of hive mind Borg-like automatons, even though they were right in their fears at what this strong AI Will Caster might become, Will and Evelyn were still portrayed as the sympathetic duo. If only people had understood that they were only trying to help us to become more than what we are, to help us evolve into a peaceful, helpful, loving hive mind, which is the goal, incidentally, of some of the leaders in the transhumanist movement. Peter Diamandis, Dr. Peter Diamandis, for example, who's co-founder of Singularity University with Ray Kurzweil, believes that humanity's destiny is to become part of a planetary meta-intelligence, a giant hive mind. I don't want to be plugged into a 7 billion member collective. And apparently, the people in the movie Transcendence didn't either. Although those who were brought into Will Caster's little private army weren't really even asked. They were people who showed up because they'd heard that he could perform miracles, healed them of various diseases, made the blind see and the lame walk. Explicitly in the film, and I don't think that was by accident, a lame man walked, a blind man was given sight. But at the same time, they were upgraded and networked into Will, so that wherever Evelyn went, Will was right there with, you know, looking through a different set of eyes. So anyway, bottom line is I thought that the movie was a very thinly veiled representation, revelation of what Mark Flynn has researched and written about in his book Labyrinth. And I want to talk to Mark about that. But I've started working on an article for the next issue of the Skywatch magazine because I think it was pretty plain. And like I said, interesting that even though the fears of the critics, the skeptics, the opponents to strong artificial intelligence were correct in their fears, they were right about what was going to happen, about the dangers, they were still portrayed as small-minded, bigoted, hateful. And the one who wanted to take over the world, become a god, to be as gods, are the sympathetic pair. And at the end of the film, spoiler alert, I suppose, when crisis had been averted by uploading a virus, which resulted in crashing the entire world's internet and basically knocked the world back about 125 years as far as technological advancement. The little garden in which that Will had created for Evelyn, because the little nanite particles that Will had created and seeded into the clouds to rain down upon the earth were inside a Faraday cage. They'd been protected from the virus, and you could see they were still active there and working at building a brave new world there in their own little Garden of Eden. So, pretty clear symbolism as far as I was concerned. But I need to, you know, do more reading on Mark's book so that I'm not misrepresenting any research that he's already done. Plus, I have this natural aversion to reinventing the wheel. So, but we'll get him on the program soon, and we'll get some other guests and programs together for you post haste as I scramble to get back to a more consistent schedule twice a week on A View from the Bunker. Our Bible study continues with our weekly chronological tour through the Bible. We're just about finished with the book of Leviticus. We have one chapter left, and then we move on to the book of Numbers. And again, it's just interesting to note that as we go through all of the chapters devoted to laws, we are at chapters that I normally skim through when I'm reading, you know, if I can confess, I skim through when I'm reading through the Bible because they're kind of boring. When you actually read through it with an eye to understanding why God considered it important enough to have Moses record it and then preserve it for 3,500 years, we're spending more time on that than on some of the really exciting historical accounts. But we'll get back into that as we get into the book of Numbers. And their weekly study is posted at gilberthouse.org by mid-morning on Sundays. So, and all the archives are online at gilberthouse.org as well, if you want to go back and pick up with Genesis. We've done Genesis. We did the book of Job next because chronologically that's where it fell in the order when it was written. And like I said, we're just about done with Leviticus now. So, we finished Exodus as well because that would have come before. So anyway, that's what we got going on there. Thanks for joining us. I sure appreciate you giving us the time to pass along this information. And again, I appreciate John's insights as somebody who understands the law. You know, it's amazing that this nation is where it is. But we have to just remember that, in the words of the old song, this earth is not my home. I'm just a passing through. This world is not my home. And do the best we can to influence, to be salt and light while we have breath. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.